Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today we're talking about the new graphic novel, 1/6. We have the writing team with us today, Alan Jenkins and Gan Golan. Thanks for joining us.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined by the artist behind 1/6, Will Rosato. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having us.
Well, I want to bring everybody into the conversation, but first, Gan Golan, you are an activist as well as a comics writer, artist, and a New York Times bestselling author. The last time we spoke, it was the aftermath of the financial collapse of 2008, and you had just published Unemployed Man with Eric Origen. That was a comic that played with the tropes of classic superhero titles. It featured heroes like Everyman and Wonder Mother, and heavies like White Rage and The Invisible Hand. It was educational, but also pretty darn witty.
Thank you. I'm glad that that's still remembered 10 years later. But, you know, I think that it speaks to how, you know, graphic novels continue to be a way to raise important conversations that we are not having enough in society. So back in shortly after financial crisis, you know, we weren't talking about what dire straits we were in financially and how it was affecting everyday people and the looming problems that presented for our country, not just financially, but politically. And so here we are 10 years later or more, and we have, I would say, more and additional crises that need our attention. And it seemed more than appropriate for a graphic novel to start to raise those questions. So we're talking about them more than we are.
So let's talk about this new title, 1/6, the graphic novel. Alan, you may be the first comics writer law professor that we've had on the show. So I want to find out more about that. But first, volume one of this title is called Remember This Day Forever. Introduce us to the story and some of the characters we meet.
So the premise of 1/6 is, what if the insurrection had been successful? And so it takes readers through real events, including, you know, white supremacist rallies and the press conference at the Four Seasons landscaping parking lot, but also into the serious business of the insurrection and the attack on democracy that our country faced. And then it imagines a world in which the rioters, the insurrectionists, were successful, in which they turned right instead of turning left. They entered the Senate chamber. They did everything they said they were going to do. Then President Trump did everything he said he was going to do, and our democracy is lost. And then over the course of four issues, everyday people rally to try to restore the democracy while arguing about what that democracy should be. The comic book medium seemed like just the right one to tell this story. As Gan said, you know, we really felt that not enough people were talking about and taking seriously the threats to our democracy that remain, all the things that are still out there, the 179 election deniers who are still in Congress and in elected positions, the anti-Semitism, the white supremacy, the authoritarianism, the now book banning that we're seeing, all really dire threats to democracy. So we wanted to take those on, but it had to be done, we felt, in a compelling way, in a way that's true to the comic book medium, that is visually stunning and also narratively compelling. And so we were lucky enough to be able to enlist Will Rosato, a veteran, talented comic book artist who's really given amazing life to some of the ideas and characters who we created.
Yes, this is speculative fiction based on history, but there's action and gunplay and derring do. Will, that must have been fun to draw.
Well, it's kind of action. It's kind of up my alley. Obviously, I've done a lot of similar subject matter, not, you know, speculative fiction history, but, you know, I've done a lot of action adventure stories in comics, and yeah, it was familiar territory, with the added kicker of being based in reality, or, you know, having elements of reality in there that we all live through or saw.
Yeah, you're quite a rising star at DC, and you've also done some independent stuff. How did you hook up with Alan and Gon?
Well, Alan just, I received an email from Alan one day, and I usually, you know, every once in a while, I'll get a cold email from someone trying to get my help on a project. And I, you know, I did a little bit of research, looked up Alan's name, you know, just sort of to make sure it was on the up and up, because I've had some scammers email me looking for work, looking for me to collaborate with them. So yeah, I recognize Gon Galan's name because I remember Unemployed Man. You know, I remember that because I have some acquaintances that worked on that project. And so anyway, from there, I asked him to give me a little bit more information on the project. And that was the beginning of the collaboration with Alan and Gon.
Now, a large part of the story is told through the visuals. So how collaborative was this? What was the back and forth process of you saying, okay, here's where maybe we should be telling the story through images, and here's the narrative through line and that sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how it's typically done in the industry, you know, and I think there's a lot of machinery and some, you know, some of the bigger companies, but we really appreciate the collaborative approach. And, you know, I would say that we try and be as detailed with the scripts as we can and provide a lot of reference material to the actual moments or people, historical documents. But it's been really beautiful to see the additional elements or the way in which Will has added so much to the story. And, you know, I often think of comic creation as a bit like a small film production where everyone has these specialized roles, maybe a lot more than people realize. You have writers and artists and letterers and colorers, all different people. But, you know, we're all working towards the same goal to make this world, to flesh it out. And there's so many details we didn't capture that Will brought to life in the story. And then a lot of advice. I would say that the lead artist is often a cinematographer and a film editor at the same time. So Will, I think, brought a lot of pacing to the story and telling us, like, you got to go back and revisit this section to make it flow better. So it's been a lot of back and forth and iterative, and I think we've appreciated that. But Will, I hand it over to you.
Yeah, I have many, many decades of drawing, doing sequential art, drawing stories, drawing different types of stories. And I guess I don't want to say that I fall back on conventions, but after a while, storytelling is kind of instinctual. And when I read a script, I see it play in my head. And I have a sense of what will fit on a page and how it can flow. I sometimes associate the layout stage or drawing a page to music. There are certain beats. You know, every story has a beat and a different rhythm and a different tempo. And each scene also has different beats and tempos, and you sort of feel it out what works best for a particular story and scene. And also with this project, I take into account that probably a lot of people that will be reading this book, this will be, well, might be their first comic book. And so I try to keep the storytelling as clear as possible. Try not to do too many crazy layouts. Try not to crowd scenes too much. Because I think sometimes, I would imagine if you've never read a comic, it can be kind of overwhelming trying to figure out what's going on. So yeah, so I try to keep it readable in that way.
Well, Alan and Gon, you mentioned some authors who are inspirations behind the story, such as Margaret Atwood and Octavia Butler. I also get a little sense of George Orwell, Rod Serling, Jordan Peele.
Well, there's definitely a lot of Serling in there. He's one of my narrative idols, to be sure. I'm old enough to have been around for the first run of The Twilight Zone and also all the marathons. And for me, and The Planet of the Apes, right, the original film, which he co-wrote, for me, the combination of compelling storytelling, of surprises, and then of, you know, core values of democracy, of equal dignity over bigotry, over information and countering authoritarianism, but told in a way that that's always entertaining, that always surprises. That to me is the, you know, the pinnacle of the kind of storyteller that that I aspire to be. I hope, you know, someday to completely fulfill that.
Well, no spoilers, but the story begins in this first issue when something has happened to ballots and things are happening in newsrooms. And there are characters who are going by their code names, working behind the scenes to go up against the situation with the second Trump term.
I love how carefully you described that. No spoilers. And I'll say there's also a lot of actions. There's a lot of leaping from the rooftops and other cool stuff. We try and drop people right in the middle of the action. And I will give away that the story starts after the insurrection has succeeded. So we're already in this alternate reality that is being built, where America is being remade along the lines of sort of this Christian nationalism that is at the root of so much of the MAGA movement. And we tell the story in a nonlinear way. We're going to go backwards and forwards in time because we're going to show people what happened afterwards, but also what led up to it. And this is why the story is going to be grounded both in speculative fiction, but also a lot of fact. There's a huge section of this story and upcoming issues that will take people through the events of what happened. And we really have done an extensive amount of research to make sure that all of that stuff is, it can be easily accessible and verified by the reader, because it was very important for us to get the factual part of this story correct. But we're going to go back and forth between these two things, what happened and what could have happened and what still might happen if we're not careful enough. So in the story, it is not just a dystopian alarm bell telling us about the danger that persists, but it's also a story of hope and resistance and what we would have to do as people to address this reality, which in our story is fictional, but, you know, we're very much talking about what could actually still happen with sort of these extreme right white nationalist forces, however you want to describe them, that are still very mobilized and still very organized. So we try and bring that all into an exciting story, as Alan was saying.
Well, we still don't know the full story behind what led up to the events of January 6th, 2021. But the information that's now starting to come out, it paints a picture of the failed insurrection as a seat of the pants affair, kind of a plan C. You know, from what we're hearing now, the Trump team was originally expecting to succeed in getting their fake electors seated from the swing states and then convincing Vice President Mike Pence to go along with the whole canard.
Now, you know, we talked to a lot of experts, people who have studied the run-up to the insurrection very closely, journalists, some of whom were there, some of whom are following the, you know, subsequent investigations and the prosecutions of some of the actors. And one of the things that we heard over and over again from a lot of these folks is that the violence on January 6th was just that, a last-ditch effort when all of the really more sinister, in some ways, machinations had failed. The arm twisting of local officials in the swing states, the fake electors, the spurious constitutional claims that were rejected by the federal courts, and then at the last moment, the violence. So the violence, of course, we have to take very seriously, and it's in part that the specter of political violence continues, and it's in some ways the scariest part of what happened on that day. But it's really important to be clear that when we look at the insurrection as a whole, it was not a seat of the pants affair. It was very specifically planned by a lot of actors, only some of whom have been held responsible at this point.
Well, we're seeing a lot of warnings that we shouldn't be letting down our guard here in Oregon during the midterm elections. We've had a lot of elections officials who are scared. One woman in Coos County, Oregon, was followed around as she picked up ballots, and a person almost ran her off the road. I mean, there's kind of this drip, drip kind of thing where more and more people who are civic minded are worried for themselves and their families and don't want to take on this responsibility. So they're leaving the doors open for people who want to come in and game the system.
Yeah, we have seen, as you're referring to, this drip, 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 these sort of smaller incidents that lead to bigger incidents. And that's why it's so important to pay attention to what happened before January 6th, and also see January 6th as part of a much larger step-by-step, you know, attempt to reach a different goal, which is to really, you know, dismantle our democracy and make it work for a very select groups of people and not for everyone. But we saw the run-up. There's a very, you know, we have a culture of forgetting in this country, so we don't always remember all of the signs that have been there. But if you go back to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which was the second largest terrorist attack on U.S. soil, it was by white supremacists and anti-government, anti-Semitic forces. And then you fast forward to what happened in Charlottesville in 2017 with, you know, the Nazis marching on the street and Trump giving sort of a tacit toleration or even approval of them, saying there's fine people on both sides. And, you know, to the stand back and stand by quote in the presidential debates where he was once again signaling to armed groups, you know, to sort of be in position and to feel empowered and that they wouldn't be stopped. And then we have the armed takeover of state capitals, you know, people marching into the halls of democracy with weapons and terrifying our elected representatives so that they're fleeing our institutions. And so there's a concerted attack on our democratic institutions in this country, and intimidation of election officials is part of it to try and remove people who are or intimidate and make people who are committed to the values of upholding democracy leave so that they can then be replaced to people who are loyal to a particular political agenda. And so this is very concerning. And all of these pieces shouldn't be seen as separate. They're very much a part of the same concerted effort to dismantle our democracy. And that's what we saw in the Capitol in that day. It was these bureaucratic maneuvers behind the scenes. It was an armed attack on the Capitol and a whole bunch of other things happening in the background. But the goals are very clear, which is, again, to dismantle and injure our democratic institutions so that our society is remade to serve the needs of very few people in a way that is very much against what we believe this country stands for and our highest democratic ideals. So we have a big fight in front of us. It's not just these small little things that we should look at as separate incidents. We should really get realistic about the danger that's there and how we, as people who believe in, you know, a civil society, who believe in democracy, who believe in an inclusive, multiracial, tolerant country, that how do we really make sure that this country lives up to its greatest ideals of being a welcoming, inclusive, and safe place for people. And that's a big task that we have in front of us right now.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking about the new graphic novel, 1-6. We're joined by the writing team of Gon Golan and Alan Jenkins, as well as artist Will Rosado. Now, you've been working closely with the Western States Center, which is an important organization that's doing work for social justice and pushing back against this sort of violence and intimidation. What's your plan for the publishing and distribution of this comic?
Yeah, well, let me start with the Western States Center, which continues to be an amazing partner, a pro-democracy, anti-bigotry organization there headquartered in Portland. So with them, we have created, alongside the comic book, a free education and action guide. So readers who want to go deeper, who want to learn more, who want to take action to uphold our democracy and address bigotry, and get some very specific tools and resources and ideas for doing that. And both the action guide and links to the comic book are available at 1-6comics.org. That's O-N-E-S-I-X comics.org. And more and more folks have been downloading the action guide and using it in their own communities to pursue their own visions of democracy and equal dignity under the law. So that part has been extremely important. To this specific question you asked, we're distributing the comic book in a lot of ways. We've given out, I think, about 4,000 free copies to pro-democracy organizations, to civil rights groups. We've given a lot of copies out to members of Congress, including 150 election deniers in the U.S. Congress, in the hopes that they can reckon with the world that they tried to create, but also lots of people of both parties who stood up for our democracy on January 6th and in the days afterwards. We've sent copies to public libraries and colleges, lots of libraries in Florida. We sent a copy to Ron DeSantis's office. We'll see. Haven't heard back from him on that. But, you know, we really want this to be a book that moves and moves hearts, minds, and policy. But we're also selling the book. So it's available on Amazon. It's available at 16comicsstore.com. And we also are making it now available at comic book stores. We hope some of your listeners will ask for it at comic book stores, because we want to, that's the way we get it out to as many people as possible. And spending a lot of time at comic cons, I have to say that I didn't really need an excuse to go to a comic con. But now I have an excuse. So just came back from Awesome Con in DC, which was lived up to its name, and hoping to be at the Baltimore Comic Con next, and also San Diego Comic Con.
And Alan, you are a law professor. What do your students think about your second career as a comics writer?
Well, predictably, my students love it. As Gon noted, we've done a lot of research for the book. And so two of my amazing research assistants, Emily Miller and Jennifer Jung, contributed to the background research on the book with enthusiasm. So it's pretty popular. I don't know yet how my colleagues on the faculty feel about it. We'll see. At least one of them has expressed his excitement, but we'll see about that. But, I think, as a law professor, a big part of my job is to help people understand the Constitution, how it should work, how it should protect everyone. And so, you know, one way of doing that is in the classroom. Another way is through scholarly articles that are, you know, read by other pointy-headed academics. And a third way is through popular culture. And so I love comic books and I love democracy. And so it's been great to combine those two things. And I've been amazed at how many people have come out of the woodwork, you know, in that shared interest.
Well, maybe you can help us learn a little bit more about a phrase that's been more common lately, and that's electoral autocracy. Because autocracy has been creeping into formerly democratic societies. We're watching the decline of the free press and independent judiciaries in places like Hungary, Poland, India, Turkey.
Yeah, this is a really troublesome time for democracy and human rights all around the world. You know, the 1960s and 70s, and really even into the 80s and 90s with the end of apartheid, were really an upsurge of the principles of human rights. We have never fully experienced them anywhere in the world, and not in our own country, but we were moving in the right direction. And now in many parts of the world, we're headed in the wrong direction. And it, you know, one of the lessons of those past eras is that it requires people power. It requires everyday folks standing up for democracy and human rights. And it also demands leadership, leadership from those elected and appointed officials and civic leaders and others who have the responsibility not only to fill the potholes, but also to stand up to the oath of democracy and human rights that they took when they took the oath of office. So, I'm hoping that we'll be a small part of that, the people power end of that equation.
Now, not to take anything away from the exciting version of Trumpism and autocracy in 1/6, but there's an article recently in Vox by Thomas Papinski. He was writing about Malaysia, and he said that life in authoritarian states is mostly boring and tolerable. So, you know, most people just go about their day-to-day lives. There are people who try to go against the grain, but they don't get heard from much.
Well, one quick thing I'll say, and I'm sure that Gunn and Will may have more to add here. It's not like autocracy is new in the United States. We've had autocracy in the South, not only with slavery, but Jim Crow. And of course, we've had lots of discrimination in lots of other places. We now see the oppression of gay and transgender people in the United States, of immigrants, of people fleeing their country's violence, trying to find human rights and safety in the United States, who are being met with bigotry and oppression and manipulation. And so it's not boring or tolerable for those people. And it wouldn't be for those of us if our entire nation became an autocracy. So, you know, I understand that point that some have made, but I think we kind of accept that perspective at our own peril.
Well, I have family from the South. I used to head down to Arkansas every summer when I was a kid. And there's a mythology that persists to this day of the Confederate insurrection of the 1860s being a noble lost cause. And this skewed version of our history was allowed in large part because in the years following the Civil War, the rebels were pardoned and allowed to return to politics, allowed to return to power, in fact, and put in place generations of Jim Crow racial oppression.
Yeah, I think there's no question that white supremacy and other structures of extreme inequality that are backed by systems of violence are very deep rooted in this country. And we come back to moments like this in history because we've never gone quite deep enough in really addressing these things at the roots. And so those false ideas about what the Civil War is about have persisted, not just immediately after the Civil War, but even today. We see that those phrases and statements are very ever present in the rhetoric of the groups of people that attack the Capitol, that are very active in the let's call it the Trump movement. But you know that the Civil War was just about freedom and states' rights and tradition, but we never talk about the freedom to do what, the state, you know, the states' rights to do what, the tradition of what, which is very much about white supremacy and maintaining slavery. And so these issues have, you know, they continue to come up in America because we haven't fully reckoned with our history and really addressed what's at the core of this. And so there is, even now, if we are able to avert, you know, this sort of extreme right hijacking of our political system, we still face the conditions that we had before Trump took power. The whole goal of, you know, really thinking about what our democracy should be in order to serve everyone isn't just going back to, you know, trying to get an establishment Democrat elected in 2016 again. Like, we have to look a bit deeper as to what is deeply rooted in our culture and the kind of economic circumstances that really allow these things to emerge in certain moments of our history. And I don't think that the combination of white supremacy and economic inequality lead to good things in any democracy. And I think we keep trying to get back to a status quo rather than addressing this inequality on a much deeper level. Because even if we make it through the next few years, those things are still going to be present and an ongoing danger to democracy in this country.
Now, Alan, I'm going to ask you to wear both your writerly hat and your law professor hat at the same time. You know, one thing we can be pretty sure of in a Trump second term is that these attempts at accountability that are going through the legal system right now, the Justice Department and the courts, would not be happening in a Trump second term. What do you think about the level of accountability? Is it going to be enough? Is it going to be what we need to keep this sort of thing from cropping up again?
Yeah. Well, first, just to be clear, our graphic novel is not about a Trump second term. It's about a successful insurrection, right? So it asks and answers the question, what if the insurrection that actually occurred had been successful, which is a different question from what a second Trump election might look like. And I'm not really going to speak to that, but I think the candidate Trump in the real world has already said that, he wants to pardon the insurrectionists, that he believes he can pardon himself. He's, of course, not admitting that he committed any crimes, but he's indicated that he thinks that's within his power. P.S. It's not. But, I think that there has not yet been adequate accountability for political actors across the spectrum in lots of different ways. Prison time is one measure of accountability. It's not the only measure, but there hasn't even been political accountability for a lot of the actors that led us to the real world insurrection that occurred. And I think if Trump or his allies are elected president, we will almost certainly see all efforts at accountability shut down, just as you saw the January 6th House committee come to an end when power shifted in the House. You saw Liz Cheney ousted from office for simply asking tough questions of the former president. And so I do think it's important for all of us to step up, to vote democracy, and to vote accountability on election day.
Subject of Florida came up, history versus mythology. And it's been pointed out that we live in a time where every year we lose more and more firsthand witnesses to events like the Holocaust and the civil rights movement. So there's a battle now for what version of history will be codified. You have governors and legislators scrambling to erase from the school books any deep analysis of structural racism, violence, segregation, redlining.
Yeah, well, it's certainly something we're seeing around the country, and it's age old, right? Holocaust denierism, for example, is a very old and horrifying trend. I grew up in a majority Jewish community, Great Neck, Long Island, and I knew many survivors of the Holocaust. My friends, grandparents primarily, but even some parents, they came to our school and talked to us about what had happened and the notion of never again, that we can't ever let this happen again. I've also been to Auschwitz. I've visited Auschwitz and seen, for example, the shoes of and hair and eyeglasses of little children and others who were exterminated by the Nazis. That's a crucial part of who and what I am, as well as, having parents who were part of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, and people who witnessed horrific things, high profile ones like the lynching of Emmett Till, but also lots of lesser known atrocities. It's absolutely crucial that we tell those stories over and over and over again. And part of the effort of this comic book, although it's fiction, but it's rooted in a lot of factual events, is to be part of that historical record in a way that, if it's compelling, if we get it right, will be hard to suppress or erase.
So the fight for history continues.
Yes. How we tell the truth about the past is how we're going to confront the reality of the future. And so we try and do both with this graphic novel, but it's, I think, really a mirror of where we are at as a country right now, which is that we have to be much more clear-eyed about our own history and what happened on January 6th as a culmination of some of that history. And really, like all alternative reality stories, all speculative fiction stories, it's really presenting us with a choice. What is the reality we want to live in? What are the choices we want to make about our future? And that's the moment we're in right now. And it's everything that we do today is going to be defining what this country and maybe the world will be like for generations. And so for everyone out there listening, who I'm sure is a very committed, active audience, but everything we do matters. And really the state of American democracy, as imperfect as it is, as lacking in so many ways that so many groups have rightly pointed out, it is still a important line of defense in protecting all the other rights and freedoms that we are still working towards. So this is a critical moment where we need to all be mobilized and make sure that we have a future that we can continue to fight for. So read the comic, but more importantly, get out in the streets, do all the important work that needs to be done to defend democracy, as well as all the other rights and important issues that we are all fighting on together.
Well, you've obviously really enjoyed working together. There's 4 issues total coming out of the 1/6 graphic novel. Got any future ideas for projects?
We got to survive this one. It's, every couple of days, there's new information about either what happened at the insurrection or what was planned. And, you know, poor Will, we're changing the script, every week and, trying to hammer things down. And also to make it interesting, I won't embarrass Will, but he, at one point he said, this particular script looks like a lawyer's PowerPoint. And he was right. Sadly, he was right. And so we had to go back and, it's got to strip out some stuff and make it more interesting. So, we'll see about future projects, but we've got 3 more issues of 1/6 coming, one hopefully next month, one in the fall, and then the final one around the third anniversary of January 6th itself.
So, Will, it sounds like you should be getting an editor credit as well.
Sure, I'll take that. It's it's a heavy crown to wear. No, I came to this project with a lot of experience in this area, and they've been good about entertaining some of my not critiques, but just entertaining my comments on script and pacing and et cetera. It's been a good project.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we've been talking today about 1/6, the graphic novel. Gan Golan and Alan Jenkins are the writing team. Will Rosado is the artist. Gan and Alan and Will, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us. It's terrific.
Much.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about 1/6 comics, give us the information again.
So it's available from Amazon in both print and digital form. It's available at 1/6 Comics Store, O-N-E-S-I-X, comicsstore.com. And the Education and Action Guide is also available at 1/6comics.org. And finally, please go to your comic book stores. Portland and the Pacific Northwest are the center in many ways of the comic book universe, and ask for this book, because that's the way we'll get it in as many hands as possible.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.